This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you for joining us. Scientists say that the Okavango Basin, which straddles parts of Angola, Namibia, and Botswana, is a vital ecological region known for its unique and biodiverse wetlands. The Okavango Delta, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is also crucial for supporting all kinds of wildlife, including some endangered species, such as elephants, lions, and numerous bird species. Kalen Costa is an Angolan environmental anthropologist and the director of the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project in Angola. He tells me that the basin is important for other reasons, such as providing sustenance to local communities through agriculture, fishing, and tourism. As the country director for Angola with the National Geographic Okavango Wilderness Project, you lead some major river expeditions in remote African landscapes. Can you share with us some of the most memorable moments or discoveries from these expeditions?
We've been going down rivers in remote parts of Angola since late 2015. And with those journeys, you do find incredible moments with biodiversity. But I would say the most special moments have come with meeting people. Some people who are living in really, really remote parts and completely disconnected from the rest of the world. They have been sharing some astonishing stories about myths, traditions, cultures, and the way we should actually try and see the environment.
And so your work emphasizes the importance of incorporating traditional knowledge into conservation. How do you navigate the intersection between traditional ecological knowledge and scientific approaches, and what benefits do you see in this integration?
My vision and our objective as a project is really to try and show that these people that we find, these guardians as we call them, have been doing conservation for millennia. These pristine landscapes that we've been encountering are as pristine as they are because of these people's traditions and ways of seeing things. They have been protecting the environment. So with that kind of information and with us absorbing more and more, we want to try and not create new systems of conservation, not inducing systems of conservation that are coming from the outside, but actually elevate and recognize the already existing traditional systems of conservation.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about your involvement with the Great Angolan Escarpment Project and, you know, some of the challenges you faced during this initiative and the lessons you've learned from these experiences.
The Great Angolan Escarpment Project has actually started in 2010, more or less, because of a small passion for birds. This small passion for birds led us to see that in some patches of these very rare Afro-montane forests, there were 12 endemic species of birds that were being difficult to see and disappearing. And the initial purpose was to create reforestation efforts and protecting the forest. But we soon realized that there was so much more. There were variables in terms of social dynamics, the necessity for people to access resources. And we've shifted from just preserving birds and forests to actually absorb the knowledge of these people about their mountains, about their forests. I think one of the biggest obstacles has been to actually provide people with hope of alternative livelihoods, of alternative means of developing, because they're also allowed to develop. But at the same way, it's been gratifying because they've been sharing really ancestral traditions that have taught us, are keeping on teaching us, how to improve our conservation perception.
Mm. Talk to us about the Angolan Highland Water Tower and the work you were doing around that.
The Angolan Water Tower actually is, as I like to describe it, one of Africa's best-kept secrets. So basically, we're talking about a region of about 150,000 square kilometers that is host to the sources of most of Southern Africa rivers. Not only just the big ones, the iconic ones, but almost all of the rivers. So we're talking about one of the sources of the Congo River. We're talking about one of the sources, or the source, of the Zambezi River. We're talking about the source of the Okavango River. And the Okavango actually doesn't exist in Angola. It's called Kuvango in Angola, Kavango in Namibia, and Okavango when it enters Botswana. So the water also comes from this place. And we're also talking about the source of the Kwanza, the biggest river of Angola that goes into the Atlantic Ocean. So because of the civil war, this area has in turn been protected for the past 40 years. That's why it's so pristine. And it's a special place because it's a unique opportunity to start preserving a place that is already preserved before it gets some sort of damage.
Mm-hmm. And your work involves engagement with communities in Angola, exploring their culture, traditions, and indigenous ecological knowledge. How do you foster, I guess, meaningful partnerships with these communities? And what strategies do you employ to ensure their voices are heard in conservation initiatives?
First of all, you need to form a relationship. And by forming a relationship, you need to be with the people. You need to go in to be with them and not to tell them things and not to tell them what to do. You need to first spend a few years
listening.
As mm-hmm. I like to say, listening is the best way to feel, the best way to understand. And once you do that, people will also listen to you. And I think that's really the key. I don't think we can speak about conservation if we're not speaking about listening to people and enhancing their lifestyles, their traditions. And conservation should be a byproduct of elevating people.
Mm-hmm. How does your collaboration with the National Geographic or being a National Geographic explorer advance your work?
So all the work that we do in the Angola Water Tower wouldn't be possible without the association with National Geographic. National Geographic has provided this platform for us to be able to traverse these rivers, to get to these people, understand their traditions. And becoming or being recognized as an explorer will really elevate those possibilities, will give me and us access to a lot more tools, a lot more help, because we can't do it by ourselves, to really protect this place and its cultural heritage.
In your recent contributions to the Brookings Institution's Foresight Africa report, you discussed the importance of foresight and proactive approaches to conservation. How do you see the future of conservation efforts in Africa evolving, and what role do you envision playing in shaping this future?
Africa has given so much to the world for the past 100 years, especially in terms of protecting the environment. What the African continent does as an ecosystem is a lot for the world, and we haven't really had the opportunity to develop like other continents have. And so it's really the time for the other parts of the world to contribute to Africa and give back what Africa has given to the world. And the only way to do that is to look at economic terms. Again, you can only speak about conservation if the people are existing in a harmonious way, if they are allowed to develop harmoniously, and only then we can talk about conservation, though conservation in Africa has been done for a while because of the way we've preserving our tradition.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 2021, the Guardians of the River podcast, of which you contributed to, won the Tribeca Film Festival Best Non-Fiction Podcast Award, is that correct?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your experience working on this project and how storytelling contributes to raising awareness about conservation issues?
So for the Guardians of the River podcast, it was really the physical manifestation of the desire to show that there is tradition. Tradition has been preserving the environment, and there is also conservation. And how can we connect both? How can we elevate tradition and show that it is also a way of conserving the environment? The podcast is a translation of our scientific data, of everything that we discover in terms of science. But science cannot be useful if you're not translating it into useful information, and that's where storytelling is so important, just like African oral tradition.
Absolutely. And finally, conservation work, as you know, often involves interdisciplinary collaboration. How do you leverage your background in biology and environmental anthropology to address some of these complex conservation conversations and challenges effectively?
I think I'll do a little bit like the elders do. They speak with analogies. So some lecturers will tell you that a degree in a university is just proof that you can learn. So even if you have a degree in biology or mathematics or a PhD, you're just showing that you have the ability to learn. Mm-hmm. And there are other ways to show that you have the ability to learn. So understanding that knowledge, and like the elder say, there was an elder asking, why is this scientist looking at this bird? I was like, no, he's trying to understand the bird. Yeah, but he's only looking at the bird. He's like, yeah, so he can understand the bird. He's like, you'll not understand anything else because he's focused on the bird, and the bird is interacting with another million things. So really, we can't do just one thing. Mm-hmm. We have to look at things holistically. Mm-hmm. And again, listen, because everything is interconnected.
Absolutely. I just read recently, I think it was actually yesterday, this quote that said, don't let your schooling interfere with your education.
That's true. We say that education is not going to school. No, that's not education. Education is learning. And absolutely, there's a million ways of learning. And in the African continent, there's no difference between the knowledge that you get as a person with your elders, your grandfather, your great-grandfathers throughout your life.
And your interaction with the community around you.
Yeah, and the university. So I would say that a 70-year-old elder in Africa has the equivalent of 50 PhDs.
Absolutely. I agree. Carolyn, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us.
Thank you so much.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Upfront on the Voice of America, connecting you on the African continent.
Hello. I'm enjoying your program. I'm Richard Mashen-Smolki from Nigeria, Taraba State, Gembu, Federal Local Government. Thank you very much.
Hello, Upfront. I'd like to hear more discussions on poverty facing Africa. And also, I want to listen more on issues concerning relationships and HIV/AIDS. And also, I want to hear more on how Africa is coping up with economy in reaction to the current global crisis.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Africa's creative sector, in particular the music industry, has grown rapidly in the past several years as Western and diaspora consumers have become more interested in both African cultural products and its talent. And as the continent continues to experience high rates of unemployment among the youth, some analysts say that outsourcing Africa's creative talent can lead to increased income, skill development, and recognition on a larger stage. Nigerian music entrepreneur Kayode Adebayo, founder of Crowd.com, a music business education and digital profiling platform for music industry professionals, tells me that his company creates links between African creative talents and Western companies that need the relatively cheaper labor skills.
The idea for Crowd basically is it's a technology that we use to match trained music industry professionals with international hiring business enterprises that want to outsource to Africa in order to kind of lower their operational cost, basically.
So producers, mixers,
journalists, social media managers. So what we do as a company, as a business also, is that we help some international, Western, or developed market enterprises manage their hiring and then their business professional services here in Nigeria. So for them, it's they lower the cost of operating globally. And then, of course, the cost of human resource here is a little bit more affordable for them. So we train and then verify and then outsource the labor here to them, and you know that whole matchmaking happens, and it's good for the local professionals because they get more paid, they get better pay for what they do, you know, more than what the local market can afford them. Then for the other guys also, the Western market guys, it's more affordable, basically, right. They probably save as much as 60% of the total cost of operations for them. So it's a win-win situation.
How do you see the music and creative industries contributing to new employment opportunities for young people on the continent? We know Africa has the highest youth unemployment compared to other parts of the world. Talk to us about some of the existing opportunities or potential opportunities in the creative arts.
So in that direction, I think Africa has a very strong biological advantage right now that that Africa itself needs to kind of come into and understand very well on how to leverage it. Between now and 2035, Africa is going to have the youngest population in the world, which is more like the youngest workforce. By the time it's 2035 thereabout, it is already pitched that Africa will have 60% of its population below 25. That's a huge advantage. Most of the developed countries will be already old, and they'll be seeking, you know, new capacities, especially in the human resource, to be able to do most of this work. Africa has a lot of advantage in the area of culture depth also, because you have 54 countries with more than 10,000 tribes, and you know what each tribe represents. You know, they have their own unique language, their own unique culture, unique beliefs, and all that. And it goes on and on. So imagine taking one tribe, looking how deep it can be, then having to comb through more than 10,000 tribes. So that's huge advantage. And the creative space. Now, let's even take films, for example. We see that the films out there in Hollywood that are kind of resonating now are the films that are like the old and remade films, which a lot of people are tired of. But why? Because there's scarcity of fresh stories, there's scarcity of fresh ideas, scarcity of fresh experiences. Africa has a tendency to be able to provide that, you know, to the world. And we see how the, you know, things like The Lion King, the Wakanda story, Black Panther, and all that, how much it did, you know, when eventually they were out there. And of course, there are opportunities. There are people right now that are looking deeper into the space to be able to kind of fetch out new diamonds and how, you know, things that become very valuable. Let's look at the music space. We see what Afrobeat is doing, what Amapiano is doing. And there are a lot of other genres in music that are still there unexplored that has the capacity to be very interesting, basically, when it comes to, you know, how we know the new technology now. You chop a little from this music, you chop a little from this music, add it together, it becomes something fresh. So we are in a very strong place of potential, especially when it comes to human resource, because on the African continent, these young people that we're talking about, they have very diverse understanding that is different from what already prevails in the West. Mm. They have very unique experiences. And, you know, an African will understand far stronger, you know, creativity, especially when it comes to colors. He sees brown a lot because of the roads are untarred. He sees green a lot because, you know, he sees fresh vegetation and all that. So all this coming into skills that helps to translate this creativity puts Africa in a very strong place, especially when it comes to what is happening now and what is happening in the future. We see that all these music artists are shutting down 100,000 capacity arenas, 50,000 capacity arenas. They are already mainstream artists on Glastonbury and all these big festivals across the world. So it shows that Africa needs to position better to capture that value within Africa, not allowing it to just go out as it's going out right now. But this is the first stage, and I believe that it will get into the growth stage and then the scaling stage. And I'm hoping that Africa will have been able to sit up then to understand how to be able to capture the value chain more and the supply chain within the African continent, basically.
Now, your company connects local talent in Africa to Western companies that are seeking people in the creative space. What specific roles and careers within these industries do you see or do you think have the most potential for growth and impact?
The list goes on and on. For example, we have people that are savvy with social media, that are social media managers, digital marketers. You have, you know, IT admin roles. You have product managers. You have people even in the office admin roles. The list goes on and on. Producers, artist managers. You have You know, very recently we got, you know, a particular role which was new to me, but it's something that is a big deal. Royalty analysts, you know, for those people that are, you know,
make music
and all that. So the role goes on and on. It's like a never-ending, you know, a never-ending. Even legal, even from the legal space, you have the people in the legal space, the licensing space, journalists. And, you know, it goes on and on because it has, from an African perspective, especially Nigerian perspective, we are not only just creators of maybe content and we are putting out into the world and it's been exported. Africa, especially Nigeria, are tastemakers also in this space. Mm-hmm. The moment music is released, even the diaspora is waiting on Nigerians to react to the music first, before they take it and start to run with it. So beyond just creating products, we are also more like the, who we call the standard structure that kind of verifies or satisfies the songs before it starts to pick up on it. So anything we don't think is cool.
You have to co-sign first before everybody.
Exactly, the world goes quiet on it. But the moment we say, this is interesting, this is good, and you say the buzz, then the world picks it up and then it starts to grow and grow. And that is the unique position. So the roles are, it's an industry. So just like you will need the CEOs to the person that cleans the floor in the office, that whole wide range is what is needed. And the moment the world is starting to see that, look, there's advantages in working and outsourcing our professional services to the continent, because it's more affordable. I wouldn't like to use the other word, but it's more affordable. So for the person I'm paying $8,000 in maybe, for example, LA, you know, to come and play a saxophone on some few songs that I'm recording as an album, I will be able to get an African, especially a Nigerian, that could probably do that for $1,200, $2,000. Saves me a lot of money. But the local Nigerian also enjoys the arbitrage, the difference between the current, the foreign exchange and the local currency, because they're able to multiply by a couple of 1,000 to 2,000 naira here, and it becomes quite something sizable for him to be able to run his own personal economy.
Right.
So it's something that is very interesting to see.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. We are chatting with Kayode Adebayo. He is the CEO of Crowd, a platform that he says that is going to revolutionize content creation and monetization on the African continent.
Now, like you said, you know, Africa's working age population is expected to grow significantly by 2035, 2045, as has been projected by the UN. And that, you know, like you said, the continent can leverage this demographic advantage to become a global talent hub in the creative industries. But what role does education and skills development play in preparing young Africans for careers in this creative industry? And how can the governments or private sectors invest in this?
Well, yeah, so it's very important, because I remember when we wanted to start to work with some international organizations, as much as they loved Africa, they loved Nigeria, they loved what we were coming up with in, you know, intelligence, in creativity and all that. I remember that one of our clients, the first thing he said then was that, Kayode, the only problem I have is professionalism. We are not sure how professional these guys are, because for me here, I hire somebody, it might be expensive, but the moment I give the person that job, I can go to sleep.
They'll execute.
Yeah, they'll execute. I can go to sleep and be sure that he will be there. But the fear I have with, you know, your people is that, look, we are not sure how professional they are, how much they understand this as a business and all that. So one of the first things we did was that we started to build relationships that had the capacity to upskill. So one of those things was that I belong to an organization called Arts Connect Africa, which is like a brain trust and resource people that have the highest of experience, especially in that whole music value chain. You have people that are booking agents for the top most best Grammy winners. You had artist managers of the biggest artists on the African continent and even globally. We had them in, you know, that whole chain. So it's a big network. One of the very things that drew me to the ACA network, we call it ACA, is the fact that it's widely, it's globally connected across all continents. Then everybody was passionate about wanting to upskill Africa. And then one way or the other, you know, talk around cultural exchanges, then economic, economic development for Africa, basically. You know, want to see that economic impact of what culture can do to change the narrative of what is on the African continent, which a lot of people relate to poverty. I joined the organization, and I'm on the board of directors now, one of the board of directors there now. And it was so unique how it aligned also with Crowd, which is our technology company. So upskilling, basically, education, very important. Monetization, very important. You know, how do we give career growth opportunities to these people that is global? Then how do we, one way or the other, make sure that what they are earning is equivalent to the level of effort that they put into it? And the third one was structure, more like understanding what inputs are and what should be the requisite output that should come from that, which technology helps to do, basically. Government must be involved in this. But what I found out also is that government is always playing catch up with things like this, because governments, you know, they are there, they are
part of the private sector and all that.
Yeah. They don't really understand what the inputs and outputs is, especially from productizing those cultural experiences and all that. So with government needs to be taught. So that's why even what we are doing right now at the ACA level is having government engagement, having engagement with the academia also, and having very close contact with the industry. So that what that does is that we are providing education and upskilling trainings to these people. And those that are already doing it, we are bringing everybody together and say, okay, if all you guys are doing this already, why don't you hand over the graduates from this particular training institutes, you know, especially training professionals at different layers. Then we now eventually onboard them to technology and then create the matching that happens between the opportunities and then the local professionals.
And the talent.
And you see how a lot of good things are happening, but it's still not happening at the scale that we want it to happen yet.
Right.
Because government involvement is slow, but I think they will get, will little by little, we'll get everybody in, we'll get the people at the finance and funding level in also, and then we'll get even the universities, we'll get them in, basically, so that it becomes a curriculum, you know, where, you know, naturally through a 4-year, 3-year period, people graduate that have this experience and exposure already, and it's easy to be able to have that wheel turning consistently and churning out good results.
That was Kayode Adebayo. He's the CEO of Crowd. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to all of you for tuning in. Remember to connect with us at voaafrica.com. We are also on social media at VOA Africa. On Instagram, we are at VOA Upfront. And on Facebook, I am at Upfront Africa. Until next time, have a great week ahead, Africa.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news. Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week for the 5-Minute VOA Newscast. We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from across the world. Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London from VOA1 and The Hits, and I welcome you to Border Crossings every day at 1500 Universal. And now that we're in August, we have a brand new giveaway for you to participate in. It's the Now That's What I Call Music Volume 87 CD giveaway with David Guetta, SZA, Meghan Trainor, Miley Cyrus Flowers, and even Morgan Wallen last night. All of that and more on Border Crossings, a service of the Voice of America.